Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is no stranger to bold pronouncements. 15 years ago, as mayor of San Francisco, he directed city officials to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, violating state law at the time. He gained national attention, and a little less than a week ago, he did it again, ordering a moratorium on the death penalty in California, withdrawing the state's lethal injection protocol, closing the gas chamber at San Quentin, and sparing the lives, for now, of 737 inmates, almost 30% of the nation's total death row population.
I cannot sign off on executing hundreds and hundreds of human beings, knowing that among them will be innocent human beings.
Well, for supporters of the death penalty, such as Los Angeles County Prosecutor Michelle Hannessy, Newsom's decision was an insult and an injustice.
This is a slap in the face to the victims of these horrible murders. It's a slap in the face to their families.
This hour on Point, California's death penalty moratorium and changing American views on capital punishment. And you can join us. What do you make of Newsom's death penalty moratorium? Nationally, the number of new death sentences is significantly down. What does that say about how we see capital punishment in the larger framework of justice in America? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll start first in San Francisco today, and joining us via Skype is Marisa Lagos. She is political correspondent for KQED and co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast. Marisa, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, let's play a little bit more tape. Let's hear more of what Governor Newsom said last week in the announcement where he said that California would be suspending or putting a moratorium on its death penalty.
What we're being tasked to do in California is to consider executing more people than any state in modern American history, to line up human beings every single day for execution for 2+ years. Premeditated, state-sponsored executions, one a week for over 14 years. That's a choice we can make, or we can make, I think, a more enlightened choice. To advance justice in a different way.
It's California Governor Gavin Newsom just last week. Marisa Lagos, why did he choose to make this announcement now?
Well, what he's saying is that essentially after he was elected, he asked his legal team to brief him on sort of what the process was going to be moving forward. You know, we haven't had an execution in California in 13 years. And this part of that was because a judge had, or the reason is that a judge ruled that the way they were doing the lethal injection could cause cruel and unusual punishment. And so the state has gone through a lot of litigation. There's been a lot of issues getting the drugs for lethal injection in other states as well. But the last governor really dragged his feet, I would say, on getting the protocols together that would allow an execution to go forward. And what Newsom was told was that protocol, he may be asked as early as this April to sign off on it, and that executions could essentially begin almost immediately. And what he says is that when he looked at sort of the magnitude of this and realized that he would be potentially being asked to sign death warrants within a few months, he just couldn't do it. And he told me that he thought this was an issue that might come up towards the end of his four-year term, not the beginning.
Okay. No. This is really actually a very helpful context here because, I mean, just to note, a couple of other states several years ago, Oregon and Pennsylvania, issued similar moratoriums, but it didn't capture the nation's attention like California's or Newsom's decision in California did because, as I said earlier, I mean, almost 30% of the entire death row population in the United States is in that one state, is in California. So that's the reason why this is such a huge move here. I mean, what has the reaction been? because, you know, California itself, you were talking about the lethal injection protocol problem, but, there's a diversity of opinion here on whether or not this has been a good move by Newsom. So give us some of the reaction that you've been hearing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it really depends on which side of the death penalty debate you land on. For supporters of capital punishment, they're very angry. They feel like the governor is doing an end run around the electorate, which as recently as 2016 voted to keep the death penalty and actually to speed it up in two separate ballot measures. I think for people who have long opposed the death penalty, they're relieved. They feel that this was the right thing from a moral standpoint to do, that Newsom is being courageous. And, you know, I think that that's a debate that's going to continue. I will say in this very deep blue state, at least, in terms of the political leadership, he's gotten a lot of support from folks in Sacramento and also people like U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, who's running for president. But, you know, I think that district attorneys, police officers, people, whose family members have been killed who support the death penalty are very angry. I think it's important to note that there are people, victims, families on both sides of the debate. And I think that's sort of something that's changed in recent years is that we've heard more from victims who actually oppose the death penalty. Right. But certainly there is a lot of anger.
Well, so let's actually hear a little bit from someone who opposes what Gavin Newsom has done. This is, you're going to hear from Mark Class right now, whose 12-year-old daughter, Polly Class, was murdered after being abducted in 1993. Mark Class told Fox and Friends on Saturday that he strongly disagrees with Newsom's decision to suspend the death penalty in California.
I have no respect for this man. He superseded the law. He turned his back on the will of the people. And he, on a whim, declared a moratorium and showed mercy for the 737 individuals on death row who have never shown mercy in their lives.
Now, Marisa, as you pointed out, there were two separate ballot measures in 2016 that Californians voted on. They rejected a proposal, just to be clear, that would have repealed the death penalty by a 53-47 margin. And they approved another proposition that would have sped up the process for capital trials and execution. So, I mean, is Newsom doing an end run, like as you said, around the will of the electorate in the state?
I mean, I think opponents certainly see it that way. This is not the first time, as you mentioned, that Newsom has done something like this. You know, we saw something similar with gay marriage. What he said when pressed about this was that during his campaign, when he sort of promised to uphold the will of the voters, you know, this was a very abstract question. And when it came down to the idea of signing the death certificate of dozens or even hundreds of people, many of whom he believes could be innocent, given how the statistical sort of number of how many people have been, cleared off of death row nationally in recent years, that he felt like, you know, the voters also gave him the constitutional authority to do this, which they have. I mean, even death penalty opponents who have really done a lot of the litigation around this believe that the mechanism he used, which was a reprieve, right? So it is temporary. The next governor could easily reverse it. But he does have that authority. But I think that's going to be a huge question. And we've already seen state lawmakers decide to introduce legislation that would become a ballot measure for 2020. But again, ask voters to repeal the death penalty. You know, I think politically the question becomes how much does Newsom sort of political stake does Newsom put into that? How much money, how much of his own time? And again, you know, we did see our last governor and Attorney General Kamala Harris, Attorney General and Jerry Brown governor, both oppose the death penalty, but really not do very much proactively to stop it. As I mentioned, I think Brown did sort of drag his feet on the protocols, which at least delayed this into the next governor's term. But, you know, I think that's going to be a question that's going to really be debated probably for years to come in California. And we'll see. I mean, you know, looking at the gay marriage issue, which I understand is very different in a lot of ways. But just if you look at the politics of these things, it's not unusual to have the electorate sort of change their mind in a short period of time about something. But this is a question that has repeatedly been put to California voters. It's generally been a very close question. And I think it's really anybody's guess sort of what will happen if they're asked again in 2020.
Right. Well, Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED and co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast, speaking to us via Skype from San Francisco. Marisa, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's listen to a little bit more of what Governor Gavin Newsom has been saying about his decision to put in place this moratorium on the death penalty in California. He spoke to NPR's All Things Considered on Friday, and he said that considering victims and their families was one of the hardest parts of his decision.
I've met with dozens of victims, some that are outraged by my reprieve, others that actually and interestingly celebrated it. I met a mother of a 19-year-old who was killed and said, "You do not have the right as governor to take away another life in my daughter's name. You will not be doing that. If you do it for my family, you'll be doing that to my family."
Well, joining us now is Phyllis Loya. She's with us from Brentwood, California. She opposes Governor Newsom's decision. Her son, a California police officer, Larry Lassiter, was killed in the line of duty in 2005, and the man convicted of her son's murder is on California's death row. Phyllis Loya, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on so that I can express my views, which are very strong on this subject.
Okay, well, so tell us, I mean, you heard that tape there from Governor Newsom saying that, you know, he was thinking of families who support his move and say that the state shouldn't be taking lives or taking away another life in the wake of a heinous crime. I mean, what is your reaction to this moratorium?
Well, my reaction to the moratorium is that he betrayed us. When he was campaigning for governor, he was interviewed by several editorial boards, and he made statements during his campaign that he was going to carry out the will of the people. It is very clear from our last election on this issue that the will of the people in California was not only to keep the death penalty, but to enforce it, to fix our system, which was broken, and stop the delay for families of decades like mine. But in listening to the remarks, one of the things that really got to me, and I'd like Governor Newsom, although I doubt he will do this, I'd like him to give me a list of the dozens of victims that he spoke to.
Phyllis, can you hold on here for just a second? I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have to just take a quick break here, and I promise we'll pick up this thought as soon as we get back. Phyllis Loya, stand by here for a moment. We are talking about California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom's decision to put a moratorium on the death penalty, on capital punishment in the state of California. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about California's moratorium on the death penalty. Almost 30% of the nation's death row inmates are in that one state, and about changing attitudes about capital punishment in America. In a couple minutes, we'll be hearing from the director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Capital Punishment Project. But with us now is Phyllis Loya. She's joining us from Brentwood, California. She opposes Governor Newsom's decision. Her son, a California police officer, was killed in the line of duty in 2005, and the man convicted of his murder is on death row. Phyllis Loya, you were telling us a little bit earlier before the break that you wanted to see the list of names of victims' families that Governor Newsom said he had been talking about. Can you tell us more about what you mean?
Because, quite frankly, I do not believe that he talked to dozens of victims of families of death row. I'm calling them out on that. I think he's being absolutely untruthful. He may have spoken to families of murder victims whose killer did not get death row. I may know which case he referred to when he's talking about the woman with a 19-year-old daughter, because I am aware of a case in which a young woman was killed who was living with her boyfriend, and her boyfriend killed her, and that young lady's mother maintains a relationship with the killer, visits him in prison, Perhaps that is the case.
Yeah.
But I, quite frankly, I don't believe he's talked to dozens of victims' family of death
okay.
killers. No way.
Well, Phyllis, can I?
One of the most visible voices in the Prop 66, as was mom of murdered 9-year-old Michael Lyons, as was Mark Class, as was the proponent of Prop 66. Pro NFL football player Kermit Alexander, who had 4 family members mm-hmm. murdered, and I know for a fact he did not talk to us. He talked to Mark Class.
Well, Phyllis, can I just jump in here? And forgive me for interrupting you. I really don't mean to, but I'd like to explore this more completely with you, if I may. I mean, the moratorium doesn't change any existing convictions or sentences. No one's going to be set free. It just means that they won't be executed by the state of California. Why is that not a satisfactory punishment in your eyes for the murder of your son?
Well, for the murder of my son, I'm 71 years old. I doubt very seriously I will live to see the execution of my son's murderer. But I don't want my grandchild growing up and spending 35 or 40 years before he sees his father's killer's execution carried out. There are families that have waited decades, over 30, 35 years, and now we're supposed to wait until he finishes his election term because he has decided to put his own personal will, and he blindsided us. Mm. He stole justice from us like a thief in the night.
So, Phyllis,
I think of Gavin Newsom.
Okay. Point taken. You've been through an unspeakable loss when your son was murdered. And I cannot even imagine the emptiness and pain that you carry with you every day since that happened. But I'm wondering if you could just explain to us who don't know that pain, what is it that seeing your son's convicted murderer be executed, what is it that person's execution would provide for you and your family? Why is it that would provide a certain closure?
Well, you know, people use closure, and I think it means different things to different people. What it would mean for me is that my fight for justice for my son would be complete when his sentence, which was by a Contra Costa County jury and by a Contra Costa County judge, would be carried out as it should be, which really basically means we have a law on the book, enforce it, give people their appellate rights, but enforce the law. Can I say a little bit about my son?
Yes, please.
You can understand what kind of person my son was.
Please do.
My son graduated from UC Davis in 1994. He then went into the Marine Corps, where he served his country as a Marine Corps officer. He attained the rank of a captain. He was a very good officer who had the respect of the people under his command. By the time my son was 30 years old, he was commanding over 350 Marines. When my son left the Marines, he left the Marines active service, although he stayed a reservist. He left active because he wanted to start a family. He came back to the community that he grew up in, or a community that he grew up in, and began to serve that community as a police officer. 3 years later, my son, responding to a bank robbery, was ambushed. He was shot twice. Even in death, my son continued to serve because my son led a life of service.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued to serve by being an organ donor, saving 5 lives. At the time of my son's murder, he was expecting his first child. My grandson was born 2.5 months after my son mm-hmm. was killed. And the closest my son got to holding his son was holding a sonogram in his cold, lifeless hands in a casket. That was my son.
Yeah. And we should say his name again, right? California police officer Larry Lassiter. That was your son. But, you know, here we are now, what, 14 years after your son was killed, and the governor of the state of California is saying that when he looks more broadly at the purpose or the idea behind capital punishment in California, this notion that it's supposed to bring more public safety or be a deterrent to the kinds of horrible crimes, you know, the horrible murder that happened to your son. He doesn't see it having been successful in bringing more safety or being a deterrent. He just sees it as causing as costing California taxpayers billions of dollars and also potentially putting wrongfully convicted people on death row. And those are also reasons why he wanted to put the moratorium on there. What's your response to that?
First of all, when we put Prop 66 on the ballot, we were able, and this is by the legislature's budget office, able to show that the reforms we were making would actually save tens of millions of dollars every year. One of the reasons that the death penalty has been expensive is because people have constantly thrown up obstacles that have had to be litigated or that have cost the taxpayers money. Our reform proposition helped solve many of those. So it's like an orphan saying, have mercy on me who just killed his parents. I'm an orphan. No, I don't buy that argument. And I also don't buy that it hasn't helped in public safety. I think he needs to talk to prosecutors. And instead, he's talking to the defense bar, and he's talking to people that oppose and getting his facts from the left agenda. That's what he's doing. His playlist is from the left agenda, in my opinion. Yeah. That's my opinion, which I have obviously very strong feelings about.
Well, Phyllis Loya, speaking to us today from Brentwood, California, she opposes Governor Newsom's decision to put a moratorium on the death penalty in California. And we should say again, her son, California police officer Larry Lassiter, was killed in the line of duty in 2005. And the man convicted of Officer Lassiter's murder is on California's death row. Phyllis Loya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for letting me have my chance to speak on behalf of my son and other victims. Thank you.
I do very much appreciate your time and your perspective. Well, let's get a completely different view here now. Let's go to Cassandra Stubbs. She's joining us from Durham, North Carolina. She's director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Capital Punishment Project. Cassandra Stubbs, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Well, first of all, respond to what you heard Phyllis Loya kind of return to repeatedly, and that is she sees Governor Newsom's decision in part as circumventing the will of the people of California, who twice in 2016 voted to preserve the death penalty and to even, you know, speed up death penalty cases and executions. And basically what Newsom's done is anti-democratic.
So what we heard at the top of the hour was that both of those ballot initiatives, the Prop 34 and then 62 and 66, were very close. So the electorate in California is very divided on this issue, or at least was in the last times. And I would agree with Ms. Lagos that we don't know what would happen in another ballot initiative. But regardless, that is doesn't tell us about what the role, the separate and important role of the executive is. And in this case, Governor Newsom had a responsibility, and I think it was a courageous and a watershed development, but he had the responsibility to look at the system and see whether it was working as the executive of California. He's governor of one of the world's largest economies, and they have this institution that is draining the courts, that is costing $5 billion and is fundamentally broken. It's fundamentally unfair. And, you know, just like we have roles for the court to come in and say when something is unconstitutional, there is a role and it's appropriate, as other governors have done before Governor Newsom, to look at the system and say, is this system working? Is this the kind of program that we can invest in?
Well, Phyllis was also talking about how this was the sentence handed down to the man convicted of murdering her son. That was the sentence deemed just, and she's waiting for that justice. I mean, what's your argument that it's not a just sentence? It's not a just outcome?
You know, I can't imagine what she has gone through and the kind of grief that she has to carry around as a result of that horrible murder of her son. But when we think about the system as a whole, we need to look broad and we need to look at how it's working. And we know that when we poll out, we see that the death penalty is failing in really every marker. It's not reserved for the worst of the worst crimes overall. It depends on the quality of your lawyer. It depends on your race and the race of the victim. Those are the drivers of the death penalty. And that just is not justice. That is not a system that we can be proud of and that we should be supporting.
Mm. I'm seeing here some statistics from California that even though they haven't actually performed an execution in 11, 12, or 13 years, the number of people on death row in California has continued to go up. It's up 28% between now and the early 2000. So what is that telling us? Is that juries continue to see the death penalty as a just punishment, or are there other reasons why California actually seems to be bucking the trend, because a lot of other states, their death row population is going down?
Well, absolutely. California is an outlier in terms of death sentences. The nationwide trend, we used to see death sentences above 300 a year, and now we're down to below 50 in recent years nationwide. And so we're talking about relatively small numbers of death sentences where juries are willing to impose death sentences. And many of those are coming out of Southern California. And I'll tell you, as someone who has studied some of those death sentencing practices, a lot of that has to do with overzealous prosecution, and a lot of that has to do with inadequate resources for defense counsel. So, and these are cases where the defendants are not getting fair trials. We may very well be convicting the innocent, but we're not going to know that and see that for another 50 years because of the delays that are built into California's broken and unfunded system.
Let's get a quick call in here. Let's go to Sharon, who's calling from Vermilion, South Dakota. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. First, my heart goes out to those who are victims of whose family has been touched by murder in these horrific acts. My brother was brutally murdered by two men back in the 1980s. They brutally beat him to death. There was a skull fracture wound where they could determine that a boot print had crushed his skull as one of the means of attack. Mm. There were 150 blows. He was a pulp. And our family decided to ask that they not pursue the death penalty because we had been against the death penalty and felt that even in this situation, we had to continue to be. We wanted to continue to take that stand. I am now, years later, extremely grateful that we did, because at a point later, 20 years down the road, 25 years down the road, actually, there was a parole hearing for one of the murderers. And my brother's younger brother's daughter and I went to that hearing. We didn't know really quite why, but we wanted to be there for Martin, mm-hmm. to make a statement. And we sat in the parole room, and they brought the murderer in, and he turned and looked at us with tears in his eyes, and he said, "There is not a day that goes by that I don't wish that I had died instead of your brother. I am so sorry for what I did. I know you can never forgive me, but I am so sorry for what I did." We held his hands, we cried, and yeah. we actually spoke on his behalf at the parole hearing for him to be finally released into society again.
Sharon, can I just jump in here for a second? I'm sorry. I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I just really, first of all, I'm so very sorry to hear what happened to your brother.
Thank you.
But, I mean, this is the kind of the fundamental question here in this question about issue about capital punishment in America. I mean, in your mind, in your heart, what is justice in the case of your family and your brother? What is the most just outcome?
Justice is a hard thing to determine. I have no problem with life imprisonment. I think actually that's a more intense penalty than killing somebody and executing them. I think forcing someone to live in a penitentiary for the rest of their life is a very intense punishment, you know. So that would be a term of justice. But to me, more than justice is healing. Mm-hmm. And you do not reach that point of forgiveness. If that man had been executed, he would never have come to that point of remorse, I don't think. And I don't think he would ever come to that point, certainly, of being able to look us in the eye and literally ask that we forgive him, knowing that there was no, we did not owe it to him in any way.
And what about your family's healing?
From my shoulders. That's the thing is, boy, the burden that lifted from my shoulder when I realized that I was able to give him that forgiveness, and it was truly amazing. It was life-changing. And I figure if that's how it felt to me, I can't even imagine right. what it felt like to him. Now, the other murderer died before he ever came to me. He never asked forgiveness. And I find myself wrestling with the realization that if someone doesn't need to ask you to forgive them for you to forgive them. But yeah. boy, it's a lot easier when they do.
Well, Sharon from Vermilion, South Dakota, thank you so very much for your call. Cassandra Stubbs, hang on here for just a second. We're going to come back in just a moment. We are talking about California Governor Gavin Newsom's decision to put a moratorium on the death penalty in California. That one state is home or has more, almost 30% of the United States' total death row population. So are attitudes about capital punishment changing across America? We're going to explore that more deeply when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom's decision to put a moratorium on the death penalty in the state of California, and also more broadly about whether or not views of capital punishment are changing across the United States. We're joined today by Cassandra Stubbs. She's director of the ACLU's Capital Punishment Project. She's with us from Durham, North Carolina. And joining us now is Jordan Steiker. He's with us from Austin, Texas. He's a law professor at the University of Texas at Austin and co-director of the law school's Capital Punishment Center, also co-author of Courting Death, the Supreme Court and Capital Punishment. He co-authored that with Carol Steiker. Professor Jordan Steiker, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna.
So I would like to explore with both you and Cassandra sort of broader trends in capital punishment in America, because I'm seeing here some numbers from the Death Penalty Information Center, and they say that back in the late 90s, 98, 99, the total number of new death sentences in those years were 295, 297. But as of 2018, that number had dropped all the way to 42. There were just 42 new death sentences in America. So, you know, regardless of what Gavin Newsom has done in California, are we seeing a shift nationwide in terms of the criminal justice system and its willingness to impose the death penalty in America?
The American death penalty is certainly withering, and it's withering really across the board, not just in jurisdictions that have few executions like California, but in Texas and Georgia and Virginia. The number of death sentences has sort of dropped off the table, and that's mostly a result of prosecutorial discretion. I think prosecutors feel less pressure and are less inclined to seek capital sentences.
And so what has prompted this change in prosecutorial discretion? Because they've had it all along, but, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, they were pushing for death sentences much more aggressively.
I think there are a few things that have accounted for the discretion and the drop in seeking death. I think first, the experience with wrongful convictions. I think that the fact that so many folks who had been sentenced to death row were later found to have not committed the offense has affected public opinion, which in turn affects prosecutorial discretion. I think the fact that every death penalty jurisdiction has moved to the option of life without possibility of parole as an alternative to the death sentence has been quite influential in prosecutorial decision-making. Opinion polls show that the support for the death penalty on as a punishment has decreased substantially from about 80% to about 60% of the American public. But if you actually ask the American public about their support for the death penalty when the option is life without possibility of parole, the support drops below 50%. So I think that's really where the American people are, that given the choice of something other than the death penalty, they favor it.
Okay. So tell us, I mean, you're there in Austin, Texas, and as you pointed out, Texas has had, of any state in the union, the most actual executions since 1976, right? So so is it this prosecutorial discretion and public opinion, is that also what's changing there in Texas?
I think it is. Harris County, which is home to Houston, used to be the death penalty capital of the United States, with which would have been one of the largest death penalty states all by itself. And there was a practice back in the 1980s and 90s of indiscriminately seeking the death penalty in any case in which it could be charged. And more recently, the folks in Houston aren't as interested in the death penalty, that neither the public nor the district attorney. And we've seen death sentences there essentially disappear, with a few years without a death sentence in what used to be the death penalty capital.
So, Cassandra Stubbs with the ACLU, let me turn back to you on this. I'm wondering if there does seem to be a natural progression in terms of a reduction of seeking the death penalty from prosecutors, does that obviate the need for kind of a Supreme Court decision on the death penalty, which I know some people who oppose capital punishment continue to seek out?
Well, I think that there will continue to be movement, not just in terms of prosecutors seeking the death penalty less or juries returning the death penalty less, but we'll see more movement by legislatures and executives and state Supreme Courts. I think that it is a broken, discriminatory, unfair system that we're going to see people turning from it going forward at the same pace, if not faster, than we have in recent years. There's just no question that the death penalty is really on the ropes here in America, and that when we look at recent developments, they're all moving in the same direction.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Winterville, North Carolina. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought today?
I have a few thoughts. One, I do think that we need to make sure that the system is reformed, that there is no longer any racial bias, that white people get the same death penalty as black people. There should be no racial preference for white people. Also, DNA, we should very strenuously use DNA to make sure fewer and fewer innocent people get convicted, and we should videotape every death penalty and every serious crime thing so the lawyers can be reviewed instantly. But after that, we should majorly expand the death penalty to anyone who commits a crime in which they try to kill somebody or in which they rape a woman or molest a child or even destroy someone's life, like Bernie Madoff, and people who commit crimes in these horrible gangs and these skinheads, you know, like the skinheads and the Crips and the Bloods, and all people who purposely use violence, not as a crime of passion or anger, but purposely commit violence.
Mike, can I just jump in here? I'm hearing you call for a radical expansion of the use of capital punishment in America. We say that happened. I mean, we'd be going in exactly the opposite direction of most of the world. I mean, what do you think it would accomplish? It doesn't even serve as a deterrent, an effective deterrent now.
Well, first of all, people who commit crimes in prisons, there have been prisoners killing guards and killing other prisoners. If they had been executed, they wouldn't kill them. And secondly, the life without parole is horrible because we're feeding these people. We're giving them medicine. And in Texas, one guy got a heart transplant who was in prison for life, and someone else had to wait for a heart. These people are predatory parasites. They don't deserve to be on this earth. Right. They've killed innocent people, and they should be gone.
Well, Mike, thank you for your call. Cassandra Stubbs, would you like to respond to Mike's view on expanding capital punishment in America?
Yeah, and I want to start, Magna, with the way that he premised it, which is that we need a system that reforms and addresses racial disparities, and we need a system that protects the innocent. And what we've seen in 40 years is that we don't and can't have that kind of system. We have tried for 40 years to fix and tinker with the death penalty to get rid of racial disparities, and we can't do it. The only way to do those, to accomplish those goals, to protect the innocent, and to end unfair racial bias in the death penalty is to end the death penalty.
Jordan Steiker, your thoughts on that?
I agree with those thoughts, but I would also say that expanding the death penalty is expanding a practice that is itself questionable, even apart from the sort of pragmatic concerns about whether it can be administered accurately and fairly. I think most of the rest of the world, and certainly all of the Western democratic world, has rejected the death penalty as a degrading punishment, as inconsistent with human dignity. And I think that one of the interesting things about the governor's statement is he has sort of revived that argument, which had disappeared from sort of the mainstream opposition to the death penalty in the United States. And I think it's an argument worth considering.
Well, I mean, you just heard our caller Mike there have exactly the opposite view on the question of dignity of the incarcerated. I mean, he wanted something far more extreme and radical, saying they don't even deserve any dignity at all. I mean, I don't know how prevalent — this is a call-in show, so I literally do not know how prevalent Mike's view is on things. But, you know, what's your response to people who see punishment as central to the criminal justice system in America?
Well, I think you can believe in the idea of punishment and that people should endure some suffering and that there's some social goals that are achieved by punishing people without thinking that we should do to people what they've done to their victims. We don't torture people who engage in torture. We don't rape people who've committed rape. And I think similarly, we shouldn't murder people and kill people who've committed murder. I think that there's something about protecting the dignity of people that is as important in this debate as anything else. And I think that it's a natural inclination to want to see those people who've done wrong suffer extraordinarily. But I think that part of what makes us civilized and part of what raises us above our worst instincts is our decision not to exercise power in that sort of way.
Yeah. Well, I want to explore for a moment what some other states have been doing regarding the death penalties. So let's listen here to this bit of tape. This is independent Nebraska State Senator Ernie Chambers. Senator Chambers has introduced legislation to end capital punishment in Nebraska at the start of nearly every legislative session in his 44 years in the Nebraska Senate. Speaking to the New York Times podcast The Daily last year, he explained why he's against the death penalty.
I believe unshakably that there is an intrinsic dignity that every human being possesses, no matter how far he or she may have fallen. And when that dignity is attacked and there's something I can do to alleviate it, that's what I will do. I don't care who the person is.
That's Nebraska State Senator Ernie Chambers. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Dan, what is going on in Nebraska regarding capital punishment?
Yeah, hi. Wanted to mention, in contrast, the California governor who has taken away the death penalty, our state's governor has worked very hard to make it happen again. He and his father have contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to politicize it and get it voted in, and then also have spent money to buy the drugs from India, which were, I think, turned away by the FDA because they were not authorized to enter the country. So I guess I wanted to make the point of, we want our governors to make a lot of decisions for us, but I think this is a decision that should not be probably made by a governor.
And then who should it be made by, Dan?
Well, I'd like to see this move up through the court system to get into the Supreme Court to have a greater discussion by the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your call. Cassandra Stubbs, respond to what Dan said. I mean, we have a 50-state system right now, and governors do have discretion, and voters in each state have discretion over what they want to do with capital punishment. I mean, do you agree with Dan that if we're to make a permanent change in the United States, that there has to be a Supreme Court case about this?
Well, I certainly agree with him that there is a role for the courts and that the courts can and should be looking at whether the death penalty is constitutional under the benchmarks of the Eighth Amendment and under the benchmarks of state constitutions. That's what we saw with Washington last year, where they looked, saw the record of racial disparities and arbitrariness in their state's application of the death penalty and concluded that that violated the state constitution. So I wholeheartedly agree that that is the role and the obligation of courts to do that kind of analysis.
Hmm. Jordan Steiker, your thoughts?
I think that the courts do have an important role in enforcing constitutional norms, and I think that the Supreme Court's engagement of the death penalty over the last four decades has been trying to examine whether the death penalty is sustainable. And I think increasingly members of the Supreme Court have been uncomfortable with whether or not the death penalty actually serves any penological goal, whether it can actually serve as a deterrent when it's so rarely applied, and whether it can serve any retributive purpose when it's so infrequently applied. And I think that abolition in the United States can only be achieved through a Supreme Court decision. But I do think that part of the process is for states to continue to reject the death penalty on their own, as many states have in the last 10 or 15 years.
Mm. We've just got about 2.5 minutes to go. Jordan Steiker, could you just briefly tell us a story of, you know, what's happening in another state here? Because I did want to have a chance to sort of explore different trends in the use of capital punishment across America. Louisiana, for example, what has been changing there?
Well, Louisiana has always been an interesting death penalty state because it has had a number of death sentences, but it's also had some deep concerns about the desirability of the practice. It has a strong faith community, a strong Catholic population, and of course the Pope has taken a categorical stand against the permissibility of the death penalty. So even though Louisiana is a deep red state politically, I think that there are a lot of qualms about the continued use of the death penalty. I think that much of the death penalty had been centered in one particular county with one particular district attorney who then lost re-election. So I do think that that's a state where we're likely to see the withering of the death penalty comparable to the withering around the rest of the country.
Interesting. So sort of different sets of forces, perhaps leading different states, but in the same direction here. Cassandra Stubbs, in the last minute that we have, I'm wondering, just to turn it back to California for a moment, Governor Newsom put a moratorium on the death penalty, but he didn't necessarily commute the sentences of the people on death row in the state. And so as we pointed out at the beginning of the program, the next governor could come and lift the moratorium. I'm just wondering, you know, we are seeing this sort of natural reduction in the number of new death sentences, but there isn't necessarily anything to guarantee that that trajectory is going to continue downward, is there?
Well, I think the fact that the more we learn about the death penalty, the more problems we find, suggests that we can expect that trend to continue. We can expect that people will continue to be uncomfortable with the death penalty's poor record for protecting the innocent, for protecting racial fairness, for protecting equality in the system of administration of justice in this country. And I think, you know, situating it within the broader criminal justice reform movement in this country, we see conservatives and progressives coming together around these issues. So I really do expect that this decline will continue.
Well, Cassandra Stubbs, director of the ACLU's Capital Punishment Project, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Jordan Steiker, law professor at the University of Texas at Austin and co-director of the law school's Capital Punishment Center. Professor Steiker, thank you so much.
Glad to be with you.
And earlier this hour, we heard from Phyllis Loya. She opposes Governor Newsom's decision as well. Thank you again to Phyllis for joining us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.